DNA is composed of simple sugars and bits of protein. What caused these simple molecules to get together, arrange themselves in a pattern with billions of tiny segments, and all of a sudden learn to divide? One plausible answer is that an invisible organizing principle is at work. The need for life to reproduce itself is fundamental. The need for chemicals to reproduce themselves is nil. So even at this most basic level, we see certain qualities of awareness, recognition, memory, self-preservation, and identity coming into play. Now add the element of time. To form a baby, a single fertilized cell must be a master of timing. Every organ of the body exists in seed form within a single strand of DNA. Yet, to emerge correctly, they must take their turn. As brain cells float toward each other, they cross paths with proto-heart, proto-kidney, and proto-stomach cells, none of them getting in the way or causing a confusion of identity. This spectacle is astonishing. Think of it. A baby brain cell somehow knows who it is going to be in advance. How does it keep track of its purpose in life with so many billions of signals being sent all around it? Memory, learning, and identity precede matter. They govern matter. I conclude that the field of awareness is our true home, and that awareness contains the secrets of evolution, not the body or even DNA. This shared home is the light spoken of by mystics. It is the potential for life and intelligence, and it is life and intelligence once they appear. Your mind is one focus of this cosmic awareness. Just as your body is held together by inner awareness, there's a flow of awareness outside you. Now let's return to the original question. Who were you before you were you? The Vedic seers say the real you cannot be squeezed into the volume of a body or the span of a lifetime. Just as reality flows from the virtual to the quantum to the material level, so do you. Whether we call this reincarnation or not almost doesn't matter. This is how a single fertilized cell learns to become a brain. It wakes up to itself, not on the chemical level, but on the level of awareness. Perhaps you are a single cell among millions too, each cell being a lifetime. Now imagine that expanded awareness is normal. Time and space could just be concepts in the material world, but dissolve gradually as you approach the quantum world. This is what I believe reincarnation is about. Former lives fall into the unexplored territory of expanded awareness. It isn't absolutely necessary to decide whether they are real or not. Verification that I was a Nepali soldier at the time of the Emperor Ashoka is never going to come my way. But if my empathy is so strong that I cannot help but adopt some of those principles, we can truthfully say that a wider range of life has influenced my mind. In a very real sense, the terms former life and expanded life are the same thing. People who shut out their former lives, if we want to use that terminology, are shutting out lessons that give this present lifetime its meaning and purpose. For someone who has absorbed these lessons fully, there's no need to go beyond this lifetime. Finally, the fact that we are not confined to our physical body and mind gives us reason to believe in the existence of a cosmic intelligence that permeates life. The timeless place where God exists can't be reduced to an address. Our exploration into former lifetimes indicates that the same may be true of us as well. The ability to know what another person is thinking, whether you call it mind reading or extrasensory perception, also occupies a shadowy middle ground between popular belief and science. ESP has hindered investigation because it isn't clear that there really is a sender and a receiver. The blurring of two minds or the sharing of one thought is just as likely an explanation. Twins can have uncanny similarities in the way their lives unfold. Extensive studies of identical twins, however, show that no stereotype covers all cases. Even when the empathy is intense, the twins do not divide into a sender of thought and a receiver. What this implies is that in the mind field, any boundary can be tenuous. If necessary, your mind can merge and communicate with another. In general, momentous events will act as a trigger, causing one twin to know that his brother has suddenly been struck by lightning. We all assume that we are the authors of our thoughts. But if two people vividly share the same thought, it may be that neither one is the author. There is simply the simultaneous reception of an idea. We can cite instances where two philosophers or scientists had the identical inspiration without knowing each other. In Hollywood, identical storylines arrive in clusters, so that millions wind up being spent on competing asteroid collision plots or volcano epics. We often say that an idea is in the air, and this may be literally true in that the unmanifest may unfold certain insights or revelations on a broad scale. Two intimately connected minds can be united at the level of awareness. In wartime, it is not uncommon for parents to know with certainty the exact moment that a son is killed on the battlefield. Awareness doesn't have to be human. It seems to pervade all life forms. You can puree a sea cucumber in a blender, pour the solution of brine and cells into a bucket, and after a while, the entire animal will regroup itself from the unformed biological sludge. These are all examples of awareness as a field beyond the body. These examples help us to shift away from a strictly private, isolated mind to a universal shared mind whose body is the universe. Isolation is a material fact, but not a quantum fact. It seems undeniable that our cosmic identity is real. In spiritual literature, the body is sometimes called the vehicle of the soul, which is another way of saying that the invisible part dresses itself in visible clothing. Actually, the body is just as spiritual as the soul. Both are expressions of the same awareness. Life and death are apportioned out in small, precise steps. Every cell in your body, as it evolved in the embryo, obeyed a host of different rules as it matured. The original fertilized ovum split into some cells in the stomach that survive only a few days, while others in the brain may last a lifetime. Now we are faced with a paradox. For awareness seems to be capable of infinite organization. It is both inside us and outside. It fights to live and yet rushes to die. This becomes noticeable mostly when it breaks down, such as when a cancer cell ultimately dies because it kills the host body. This outcome is obvious and would be communicated to the cancer cell if it were in contact with the body's basic intelligence. Yet somehow, this natural connection has been broken. In psychological terms, a similar thing happens with alter egos or its clinical extreme, multiple personality syndrome. Alter egos are formed under psychological pressure. The negative energies of hatred, child abuse, humiliation, and so forth get played out as if they belong to someone else. At the unmanifest level, each of us is many people. You can define this in terms of lifetimes, but that isn't necessary. When you read a novel with a fascinating character in it, you blend into that figure so that you can have the experience of being inside someone else's skin. Neurosis is often marked by this kind of influence, where an inner child with all its fearfulness continues to preside inside an adult personality. The extreme state of this is alter egos. From the perspective of the mind field, an alter ego can actually change the body to conform to it. Striking cases are on record, in which a single personality may be diabetic or allergic, while the others show no signs of these disorders. To claim that the brain could form different reactions for a dozen personalities is not credible. It would defy everything we know about childhood development. Alter egos must come from a region beyond personal experience. They are like voluntary incarnations or partial incarnations activated from the storehouse of the mind field. In a society where we do not cultivate spiritual relationships, we continue to foster our alter egos, the many experiencers who are born with every experience. From the virtual perspective, our lives are therefore spent in illusion. To discover our true nature involves a process of growth, and part of that growth is to deal with conflicts within the limits of yourself. Multiple personality syndrome is a strategy that works in the short run, but the person is just a collection of disorganized fragments. We are all multiple personalities in that we switch from one role to another every day. But the real I exists beyond my roles and then manifests as father or doctor or son with a flicker of intention. To be grounded in this I is to be an alert witness to the roles we assume. This alert witness, because it exists in the virtual realm, approaches the mind of God. It may even be a part of God, for we assign to God the role of cosmic witness. We have gone beyond the illusion of our ever-shifting ego, and any step closer to the witness is moving closer to the divine. To the human mind, time has always flowed toward us. But to hold that God, a timeless being, sits outside the universe and plans the tick-tock of creation is no longer tenable. We assume instead that randomness rules. Science has offered chaos theory to demonstrate that disorder lies at the heart of nature. A coincidence says otherwise. It is like a momentary reprieve from chaos. Someone decides at the last minute not to board a jet that later crashes, or when any train of events takes place that is exactly what is needed to reach an outcome. Jung invented the term synchronicity to cover these meaningful coincidences. What outside force can organize time in such a way that two things meet with a sense of fatefulness? My own life has been touched often by synchronicity, so much so that now I get on an airplane expecting the passenger in the next seat to be surprisingly important to me, either just the voice I need to hear to solve a problem, or a missing link in a transaction that needs to come together. Therefore, my thoughts on this matter are highly personal. I believe that all coincidences are messages from the unmanifest, sudden interruptions of superficial life by a deeper layer. On the scientific side, however, I also suspect that there are no coincidences at all. Our DNA is both in time and outside it. It is in time because all bodily processes are subject to cycles and rhythms. Yet 99% of your genetic material lies dormant until it needs to uncoil and create a mirror image of itself. How does an inert chemical decide to wake up, and when? For a child to lose her baby teeth and replace them with adult ones, DNA has to know a great deal about the passage of time. Death itself may be coded into our cells. A tribe of mostly young childbearing members would be able to fight and gather food better than one burdened by old people. How does DNA have any sense of time? It lives in a purely chemical world surrounded by molecules that float by. Cells stand at the forefront of life, storing no more than 3 seconds worth of food and air. Researchers can isolate those enzymes needed to trigger any given process in a cell. This doesn't really tell us who decided to send the messages in the first place. Ultimately, all messages are sent by DNA to itself. Looking outside our bodies, one can assume that DNA had to evolve in a random world. Except for the rotation of the planet and the change of seasons, DNA wasn't exposed to a world of precise timing. Yet when DNA took the immense step of learning to reproduce itself, a mastery of time came along. Bits of nucleic acid learned to read a watch down to thousandths of a second, and no amount of trauma from the outside world has made a dent in that ability. DNA's mastery of time is woven into the texture of life itself. Having seen this, the leap into synchronicity is not far. We only need to add the subjective ingredient. Time has been ordered to benefit me not just for my genes. A friend of mine was stepping onto a bus one day, wondering if he should heed the advice of a certain spiritual teacher, when the man ahead of him turned around and said, "Trust him." Ultimately, we would have to say that we are really communicating with ourselves. The whole is talking to its parts. Synchronicity steps outside the brain and works from a larger perspective. In spiritual reality, literally everything happens because it is meant to. The world is a meaningful place. Everyone is working out their life's purpose. At synchronous moments, you get a peek at just how connected your life is, how completely woven into the infinite tapestry of existence. Like our DNA, we have always flowed with the river of time and sat on the banks observing it simultaneously. Time captures our attention and pulls us into its web. When we consider that we might be weaving the web, the possibility opens that God is sharing this task with us. Every aspect of creation requires us to be a co-creator, and this notion makes intimacy with God more and more likely. As we have seen, the things in the material world turn into phantoms the deeper we go into the unmanifest domain. Time is no exception. When the boundary of time dissolves completely, it is possible to experience clairvoyance or the ability to see into the future. The clairvoyant is experiencing an unreal visual state, yet the vision happens to come true. How can a purely internal firing of neurons match events that have not come to pass? I know of clairvoyants who give accurate images of a future mate or the outcome of a lawsuit, down to the exact timing of a judge's rulings. This accuracy gives serious pause. It implies that there is more than one way for the future to flow into the present. It can choose those who will see and those who will be blind. We may be choosing not to be clairvoyant so that our belief in a hidden future is confirmed. There are no definite events, no river of time that flows from past to present to future. What exists are infinite choices within every event, and we determine which select few are going to manifest. In the clairvoyant's vision, the future has two locations, here and later. He can choose which one to participate in. Those of us who accept a simpler world in which the future has only one location, later, are showing a personal preference. We are not obeying an iron law. Time dictates that first one thing happens and then the next without overlap. You cannot be a child and an adult simultaneously, except through clairvoyance. Then the leaking of one event into the next is allowed. Our DNA has to be clairvoyant. The first fertilized ovum contains a map of the future imprinted in invisible ink. In general, the highest purpose of clairvoyance may be to give us a glimpse into the mind of God, because a divine mind does not recognize past, present, or future. This is the ultimate mystery of clairvoyance. Any moment, whether now or later, is a doorway into eternity. I believe that prophets live in this expanded space as well. We can begin to understand how this works only by our knowledge of quantum reality, for there all light is born. Energy is not separate from space-time. They form one tapestry. The astrologer goes a step further. He breaks the entire cosmos down into specific kinds of energy as they apply to human existence. The concept of information embedded in energy isn't totally alien outside astrology. To a physicist, information is pervasive throughout nature. The specific frequencies that make gamma rays different from radio waves all form a kind of cosmic code. It is the information embedded in energy that allows us to build electrical generators, radio beacons, and so forth. Without that coded information, the universe would be a random vibration. In India, a detailed system of astrology called Jyotish, the Sanskrit word Jyoti means light, asserts that the information coded into energy has human significance. The future is spelled out in light. Photons actually speak to the astrologer, forming exact patterns that will emerge eventually as events in time. If I were to go to Banaras and visit a Bhrigu reader, a type of astrologer, the test of his authenticity would be that my chart would be waiting for me, detailed down to the minute that I crossed the doorstep. To be able to cross the boundary of time, or to speak the language of light, tells us that even our most basic assumptions are open to choice. Awareness is all. The past and the future are distractions, pulling us into an abstract mental state that will never be alive. Once awareness is willing to expand, you can dive infinitely into this moment. If we experience our minds as multidimensional, we will get closer to God's mind, which is all-dimensional. Contacting God. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. Matthew 7:7. Knowing God would be impossible if He didn't want to be known. There is nothing to prevent every stage of spirituality from being a delusion. The saint who speaks to God may be suffering from a lesion of the right temporal lobe. On the other hand, a convinced atheist may be shutting out messages from God every day. Our quantum model tells us three ways that God is already contacting us. He exists at a level of reality beyond the five senses. Since we are quantum creatures, we participate in God all the time without acknowledging it. He is sending us messages or clues into the physical world. He is attracting notice through second attention, the deepest intuitive part of our brains. These three ways to know God are based on the facts accumulated in our search so far. We've built the plane and we know the theory of flight. What remains is to take off. God seems to be sending us messages from outside time and space. Some of these are very dramatic. One of the most recent healings at Lourdes happened to a young Irishman afflicted with multiple sclerosis. He arrived late after the holy waters were closed. Disappointed, he was taken back to his hotel in a wheelchair. Sitting alone in his room, he suddenly felt a change. A bolt of light shot up his spine. He lost consciousness. But when he awoke, all signs of his MS had vanished. He returned home healed. I think there is no doubt, given the thousands of people who have had such experiences, that this is the light of God, revered in every sacred tradition. God enters our world in few other ways that are as tangible. In research polls, up to half of Americans say that they have experienced some form of light that they couldn't explain, either internally or as an external aura or halo. About a third of Americans say that they are born again, which we can interpret as a spiritual awakening of some kind. A form of supra-consciousness, as the Indian saint Sri Aurobindo termed it, is gradually descending upon us, beginning with the higher centers of awareness, those that cause us to intuit God's existence, making its way down until our very selves are transformed. To get back to the source of God's messages, we would have to use second attention, our ability to know something without any physical information. Intuition and prophecy involve second attention, so does the saint's insight into God. By seeking to know God, we run into the same problem we do when we seek to know what lies outside the universe. Without ever seeing into this other world, we can observe black holes and quasars, which are the nearest thing to windows on the edge of infinity. As light and energy get sucked into a black hole, they disappear from our cosmos. This implies that they are going somewhere. Therefore, they might also return to us via white holes or acts of creation like the Big Bang. God is not this knowable, however. The great fascination of near-death experiences is that people return convinced that they have entered the divine presence. But near-death experiences can be duplicated artificially through oxygen deprivation to the brain. In these cases, the same white light often appears, so perhaps it is just an artifact of the cerebrum as it begins to suffocate. we need better proof. To know God personally, you must penetrate the boundary that physicists call the event horizon, a line that divides reality sharply in half. On this side lies anything that remains within the speed of light. On the other side is anything faster than the speed of light. The speed of light is absolute. It is like a wall that no object can crash through. As we approach the wall, time slows down, mass increases, and space becomes curved. If you try to crash through, weird things happen to prevent you from doing so. For example, any light that passes too near a black hole gets pulled into its field of gravity. Black holes are the remnants of old stars that collapsed onto themselves. In some instances, the momentum is irreversible, and even light cannot escape from the star's force field. In that case, there is only blackness. If a photon of light tries to go around a black hole, it will start to curve in the hole's direction until it falls in. To an outside observer, the photon falls into the black hole forever, frozen in time. Inside the black hole, however, the photon has already been devoured. Both versions are true. One is seen from the world of light, the other from the world beyond light. This borderline of uncertainty is the event horizon, the margin dividing reality between the certain and the uncertain, the known and the unknown. Any place where knowledge stops, there is also an event horizon. The brain can't explore beyond where photons go. What lies beyond the event horizon? It could be a new universe with intelligent life in it, or it could be a chaos of squashed dimensions. Quantum physics dips across the border all the time, only it can't stay there very long. When a particle accelerator bombards two atoms, causing a subatomic particle to jump out of its hiding place for a few millionths of a second, the event horizon has been crossed. Science inched its way toward nuclear power, transistors, and if we look into the future, advanced computer memory and time travel. Already, a beam of light has been made to move from one location to another in a Caltech laboratory without crossing the space in between, which is a form of primitive time travel. What we do know is that God can't be on this side of the event horizon. Since the Big Bang, light has been traveling for about 10 to 15 billion years. Strangely enough, certain faraway objects appear to be emitting radiation that is older than the universe, a fact cosmologists are unable to comprehend. If the human brain contains its own event horizon, the limit of photons to organize themselves as thought, and so does the cosmos, we must cross over to find the home of spirit. In the ancient Vedas, it says that the part of us that doesn't believe in death will never die. This simple definition of the soul is not a bad one. It accurately describes everyone's secret belief that death may be real for some, but not for us. Psychologists are impatient with this feeling of personal immortality. They claim that we use it to defend ourselves against the inescapable fact that one day we will die. But what if the opposite is true? What if feeling immortal and beyond death is the most real thing about us? To prove this point, one way or another, we need facts, just as we needed them about God. The soul is as mysterious as God, and we have just as few reliable facts about it. The soul is not really as personal as people believe. The soul doesn't feel or move. It doesn't travel with you as you go about your life, nor does it endure birth, decay, and death. This is just a way of saying that the soul stands apart from ordinary experience. Since it also has no shape, getting a mental picture of the soul is impossible. The soul is really a junction point between time and the timeless. It faces in both directions. When I experience myself in the world, I'm not experiencing my soul, yet it is somewhere on the periphery. There is no doubt that we sense its presence, however vaguely. But it would be a mistake to think that the soul and the person are the same. My grandfather was an old man with thinning hair, prone to enthusiasm and fierce in his love for us. I have very powerful memories of him, yet all his qualities and all my memories have nothing to do with his soul. Those qualities died with him, his soul did not. So the soul is like a carrier of the essence. But what is that essence like? If I can't experience my soul as an emotion, if everything I know about myself since birth is separate from my soul, it must not be a material thing. The soul begins at the quantum level, which makes sense, since the quantum level is also our doorway to God. To go through this door isn't something we choose. Participation is mandatory. In India, the soul has two parts. One is called Jiva, which corresponds to the individual soul making its long journey through many lifetimes until it reaches full realization of God. When a child is taught that being good means your soul will go to heaven, it is Jiva that we are talking about. Jiva is involved in action. It is affected by our good and bad acts. It rules our conscience, and all the seeds of karma are planted inside it. The kind of person you turn out to be is rooted in Jiva, and the kind of life you make for yourself will change Jiva day by day. The second half of the soul, called Atman, does not accompany us on any journey. It is pure spirit, made of the same essence as God. Atman cannot change in any way. It never reaches God because it never left in the first place. No matter how good or bad your life, your Atman remains constant. In fact, the worst criminal and the holiest saint have the same quality of soul when it is this aspect that is in question. There is no good approximation for Atman in the West, and many people might wonder why the soul has to be divided in this way. We have seen that all the familiar qualities of life, such as time, space, energy, and matter, gradually fade into a shadowy existence until they disappear. But this disappearance leaves something intact, spirit itself. Jiva lives at the quantum level, Atman at the virtual. So the faintest, subtlest trace of me that can be detected at the quantum level is Jiva. And once it disappears, pure spirit remains. That is Atman. The distinction between them is absolutely necessary, for otherwise the path back to God would break down. You need Jiva to remember who you are personally. You need Atman to remember yourself as pure spirit. You need Jiva to have a reason to act, think, wish, and dream. You need Atman for the peace beyond all action. You need Jiva to journey through time and space. You need Atman to live in the timeless. You need Jiva to preserve personality and identity. You need Atman to become universal, beyond identity. As you can see, even though they are melded together as soul, these two aspects are exact opposites in many ways. Such is the paradox of the soul, that it manages to accommodate itself to our world of time, thought, and action, while dwelling eternally in the spiritual world. The soul must be half human, half divine, in order to give us a way to retain our identity during all the prayer, meditation, seeking, and other spiritual work that is involved in finding God. And yet the soul must have a divine aspect that embodies the goal of all seeking. On the material level, I am not aware of my Atman. I walk and talk and think without any consciousness that my source lies much deeper. But at the soul level, I am totally aware of who I am. The soul level is a very strange place, because it gives rise to all activity without being active itself. Think about that carefully. As I travel around from here to there, my soul doesn't move, because at the quantum level, the field just ripples and vibrates. It doesn't change location from A to B. I am born, grow old, and die. These events have tremendous significance for my body and mind. Yet at the quantum level, nothing is born, grows old, or dies. There is no such thing as an old photon. We can get some clues to this riddle from a common device, a television set. When you see a TV character walking from left to right on the screen, your brain registers a false impression. Nothing on that screen, not a single electron, has actually moved from left to right. With a magnifying glass, you would see that the only activity taking place is the flickering of phosphors on the surface of the cathode ray tube. If phosphor A is to the left of phosphor B, its flicker can be timed so that just as it goes off, phosphor B lights up. The trick makes it look as if something has moved from left to right, just as twinkling Christmas lights seem to circle around the tree. Now let's apply the same trick to ourselves. When I get out of my chair and walk across the room, my body seems to be moving. But in fact, nothing of the sort is happening at the quantum level. Instead, a series of virtual particles is flickering in and out to create the illusion of motion. This is such an important point that I want to give several more examples. Go to the beach where ocean waves are crashing on the shore. If you wade out and put a cork on the water, your senses tell you that it will be carried along by the waves. But it isn't. The cork stays in place, bobbing up and down as the waves pass along. The water is also just moving up and down. It is the same water that hits the shore, not new water carried from miles away. The wave motion takes place only at the energy level, creating the illusion that the water is getting nearer to the shore. Now the examples get more mysterious. When two magnets are drawn to each other, what pulls them together is the magnetic field. But the field itself doesn't move. All over the world, compass needles are wiggling, but the Earth's magnetic poles aren't. How does a non-moving field make a needle or two heavy pieces of iron move? Again, it's an illusion. At the quantum level, virtual photons, acting as carriers of the magnetic force, flicker in and out, and because they do this in sequence, the appearance of motion is created. Let's assume that we can accept the fact that you and I are not moving either. To a quantum physicist, our bodies are just objects like any other. A ball thrown across the room isn't moving, only winking in and out of existence at an incredibly fast speed at different locations, and we are no different. But here the mystery deepens. When the ball disappears for a nanosecond, only to reappear just the tiniest bit to the left or right, why didn't it disintegrate? After all, it was completely absent for a while, and there is no reason why its old shape and size and color shouldn't simply dissolve. Quantum physics can even calculate the odds that it won't reappear, that instead of a ball flying across the room, a bowl of pink jello will suddenly appear. What keeps things together? This is essentially the argument for the soul. It holds reality together. It is my off-screen director, my presiding intelligence. I can think, talk, work, love, and dream, all because of the soul. Yet the soul doesn't do any of these things. It is me, yet I would never recognize it if we came face to face. Everything that makes the difference between life and death must cross into this world via the soul. Today I sat down to see if I could list all the invisible events happening at the soul level, and the results inspire a deep awe at the soul work which the medieval church called psychomachia, going on with every breath. Infinity is becoming finite. The unmoving is starting to move. The universe is shrinking to a location inside you. Eternity is taking on the appearance of time. Uncertainty is becoming certain. The undefined is becoming definite. That which has no cause is starting the chain of cause and effect. Transcendence is coming down to earth. The divine is taking on a body. Randomness is turning into patterns. The immortal is pretending to be born. Reality is putting on the mask of illusion. God can be defined in infinite ways, but one version of God is that He is a process. The process involves bringing life into being. Science has its story about how life originated 2 billion years ago from a soup of organic chemicals. This soup, probably contained in the Earth's ancient oceans, was struck by lightning and began to boil into primitive, self-reproducing nucleic acids from which the long chain of evolution proceeded. But from the spiritual viewpoint, Life is being created all the time through soul work. There is more to life than raw creation. The soul, as every religious tradition has insisted, exists to bring an end to suffering. The same cannot be said about any other aspect of ourselves. The mind, ego, and emotions cause as much pain as pleasure. They can throw us into turmoil and confusion, despite all our efforts to reach clarity and peace. The soul has been assigned the unique function of working only for what is most evolutionary in each person's life. It couldn't accomplish this end by turning the infinite into the finite, the timeless into time, and so forth. These processes have no human value until we add another ingredient, the dispelling of suffering. Someone who is attuned to the soul begins to perceive that a subtle guidance is at work. The soul is silent, therefore it cannot compete with the contentious voices heard in the mind. You can spend years overshadowed by anger, fear, greed, ambition, and all the other distractions of inner life, but none of that activity touches Atman. The soul has its own project. The Vedas describe this in terms of the five kleshas, or causes of human suffering. They are ignorance about the nature of reality, identification with the ego, attraction toward objects of desire, repulsion from objects of desire, fear of death. The great sages and seers who laid out the scheme of suffering all emphasized that all five causes boil down to one, the very first. When a person forgets that he has a soul, that his source is rooted in eternal being, separation results. And from separation, all other pain and suffering follows. I think a modern restatement would go something like this. A person thinks that only material existence is real, and thus becomes totally ignorant of the source, which is quantum and virtual. He accepts the illusion of time and space. When this happens, contact with the source is lost. The voice of the soul begins to grow fainter and fainter. Drifting in separation, the person seeks desperately for something to cling to. Life cannot abide being without a foundation. Therefore, the mind creates an entity known as ego. This I is the same as the personality. It is constructed from all kinds of experiences, and as these become all important, the I and its needs have to be defended at all costs. The ego has many needs, and so it begins to value the fulfillment of those needs. The whole world becomes a means to make the ego stronger, more important, and more secure. To that end, it pulls all kinds of objects toward itself: food, shelter, clothing, money, etc. For a time, this strategy seems to work. Although it never becomes truly secure, the ego finds that life can be filled up by acquiring more and more. No one can gain complete control over the environment, however. Therefore, the ego has to spend a great deal of time avoiding pain and danger. As attractive as certain things are, others are equally repulsive. Caught in a whirlwind of seeking pleasure and avoiding pain, the person achieves many goals. The years pass, and separation does not even seem to be a problem anymore. However, there's an end to all this acquiring, all this experience for the sake of experience. Over it all looms the certainty that life will end. Fear of death becomes a source of suffering because death is the undeniable reminder that the ego's strategy for survival never solved the original problem: ignorance about how things really work. If it is true that the five kleshas are still at work, and who could deny that they are, then the influence of the soul is crucial. Each klesha has its own momentum. We all know the powerful addiction of money, power, career, and ego needs of every type. This momentum has kept suffering alive despite the enormous changes in human existence from age to age. Against this momentum, the soul provides a means of solving every cause of pain. Ignorance of reality is solved by delving deeper into the mind. Awareness dives deeper than the material level to find its roots. Identification with ego is solved by learning to identify with these deeper levels. Attraction to outside objects and repulsion from them is solved by valuing the inner life above all. Fear of death is solved when the soul is experienced directly, since the soul is never born and never dies. As with the five causes of suffering, the five solutions all grow from the first one. If you explore the true nature of reality, all pain will eventually come to an end. In some form or other, religious teachings state this truth over and over. There is no way around the fact that it sounds abstract, yet this is the reality of how the soul operates. Your soul deals in abstractions like eternity and infinity so that you won't have to. It converts an inconceivable world into one that we can grasp and understand. Like a car's transmission, which takes the whirling motion of the engine and transforms it into the forward velocity that gets you where you want to go, the soul makes it possible for your life to move forward. Eternity doesn't need to breathe. Infinity doesn't need to find a job. But you need those things and more. You need to eat, work, love, and raise children. And these are made possible through the soul. Without it, there would only be quantum soup, a formless swirl of energy and particles. Now let's see if we can test this new conception of the soul against tradition. Even though we are accustomed to using religious language about the soul, its duties are useful, not poetic. This fact has been hard to realize because the word soul has been used loosely to mean a person's deepest emotions, his heart, his highest aspirations, as well as more arcane things like the Holy Ghost. In the Bible, where the word soul is used hundreds of times, we find that it goes through every struggle of life. In the Old Testament, we hear a lot about the peril of the soul. Satan wants to grab it. The enemies of Israel want to destroy it. Famine and illness make the soul heavy. And always there is the plea. This is heard over and over in the Psalms, for God to give balm and solace to the soul. Jehovah is fickle, however, and he can seem to betray even those souls offered up to him. The book of Job begins with God and the devil gambling with the soul of a righteous man who feared God and set his face against wrongdoing. For no other reason than to test him, God allows Satan to inflict any harm he wishes against Job except to touch his person. Job's travails with sickness, poverty, family misfortune, and social rejection describe a condition of suffering that was familiar to the Hebrews and later to the Christians. The fact that God never again speaks in the Bible is an ominous afternote. The soul has been left to survive its tests alone. The New Testament continues the same drama, but more in terms of salvation and redemption. Since Jesus offers an explicit promise of an afterlife, going to heaven is the goal of the soul, and escaping damnation is its greatest challenge. In all this turmoil, one senses that the soul travels through life undergoing every anxiety felt by the person. It isn't aloof or apart, but very much down here in the mud of battle. The paradox is that throughout this highly emotional involvement, no biblical writer ever defines what the soul is. As a result, the word remains as diffuse in the end as it was at the outset. If I say to you, "My soul was touched," or "I mean this from the bottom of my soul," or "that person has a lot of soul," nothing specific is being conveyed. I would venture that the sacred masters, whatever religion they are associated with, were trying to be quite specific. In their awareness, the soul meant something much like what we have been describing, a connection between the world of the five senses and a world of inconceivable things, like eternity, infinity, omniscience, grace, and every other quality of the unmanifest.